So, what is the essential teaching of Buddhism? The basic fundamental teaching that distinguishes Buddhism from all other spiritual traditions or spiritual paths? Is it the Four Noble Truths? The Four Noble Truths are all about dukkha, which is the word usually translated as suffering, and that's clearly the most important term in all of Buddhism. But actually, there's nothing distinctively Buddhist about any of the Four Noble Truths. I'm sure you're all familiar with those truths, right? Life is dukkha, the word usually translated as suffering. The cause of dukkha is craving, or thirst, literally. That there's an end to dukkha, nirvana, awakening, and finally the Eightfold Path. But all of those are kind of a truism. They were all sort of truisms of Indian philosophy, the Indian spiritual path of the time. All of Indian religion, unlike Western philosophy, which begins in wonder, all of Indian philosophy, the Indian spiritual path, it always begins with dukkha. It always begins with our fundamental problem, the problem of the human condition. They all talk about the problem of craving. They all have some understanding of liberation or enlightenment. And they have their own spiritual paths. In fact, yoga, the Samkhya yoga tradition, has an eightfold spiritual path, very similar in many ways to Buddhism. Of course, Buddhism has its own take on the Four Noble Truths. And those of us who teach Buddhism find it very convenient to sort of use those four as a template to sort of put everything else inside them. But to say it again, there's nothing distinctively Buddhist about any of those four truths as usually expressed. So again, what's distinctive about Buddhism? What really distinguishes it? You want to say? You
Are
want
we
try?
Supposed to answer?
Sorry?
Is it that there's no self? No?
That's half of it. That's half of it. Good. Anybody else want to try the other half? Yes.
To expand upon that, the lack of inherent characteristics of all phenomena.
Okay, that's pretty close to the same half. But can we bring the other term into it, the word dukkha? Right. I mean, dukkha is the word usually translated as suffering, as we said. But in fact, that's much too narrow a translation, unless we understand it in the broadest possible sense. Obviously, not all life is dukkha, right? There's lots of other things going on in our lives.
Mindfulness?
That is the path that helps us realize the fundamental insight that Buddhism talks about, the fundamental insight that I'm trying to kind of zoom in on. But that itself is not, again, not distinctively Buddhist. You'll find mindfulness in other Indian and religious traditions. What I think it is, just to jump to the end, it's the connection that Buddhism makes between dukkha, this fundamental suffering in the broadest sense, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, basically our obvious inability to live as happily as we should, or we think we should, and the sense of self. What Buddhism is basically saying is that the fundamental dukkha that causes us so much suffering is our sense of self. And that in order to resolve dukkha, we have to resolve, let go of, realize the emptiness of the sense of self. The Pali Canon sometimes distinguishes dukkha into three different types. The first type includes everything that we normally think of as suffering, physical, mental, emotional. It even includes things like being separated from somebody that we want to be with, and being stuck with somebody that we don't want to be with. The Buddha actually said that, just reminding us. You know, there's a lot of funny stuff in the Pali Canon that we tend to miss. But that's all the first type of dukkha. The second type of dukkha has to do with impermanence. It means that even when you're enjoying an ice cream cone of your very favorite flavor of ice cream, even while you're enjoying that ice cream cone, there's dukkha built into that. Why? Because at some level we know it's intransient, it's impermanent, it's going to pass away. And even if you have enough money to buy as many cones as you like, you know, you can only eat so much ice cream before. Right? There's an awareness of the transience. And that, according to the Buddha, is also a kind of fundamental dukkha. And I suppose the classic example is our mortality. Because we know, unlike other animals, we're all too aware that we're going to die someday. We've just been reminded of that with the death of one of your members, mm-hmm. parents, father. And for many people, maybe all of us to some extent, that interferes with our ability to become one fully with our life. It's like something hanging on our shoulder, you know, constantly whispering in our ear, reminding us that you know, life is short. It's that awareness of impermanence actually interferes with our ability to live fully right here and now. So that would be the second kind of dukkha. But it's the third kind of dukkha that I want to focus on, which is the dukkha connected, literally it says connected with conditioned states. And that can be understood a couple different ways, but it clearly includes sense of self. I say sense of self because, of course, Buddhism denies that there is any self-existing self, soul. And yet we have a sense of self. We have a sense of separation. And that sense of separation, the sense that, you know, David Loy is in here behind the eyes and somewhere maybe inside the ear, somewhere in here, and you, the world, is out there. That sense of separation is the fundamental delusion and the fundamental source of our dukkha. To have a sense of self is to also have a sense of other, that which is not self. And it's that separation that causes the basic problem. I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh who said, very simply, we are here to overcome the illusion of our separateness. And again, to emphasize the connection between the separateness and the sense of self. The sense of self is that which is separate. And by feeling itself in a deluded manner to be separate, it's inherently dukkha. So what Buddhism is getting at, I think, is that to say life is dukkha is not to say that we're suffering all the time, but rather because of this delusive sense of self, it's the nature of an unawakened mind to be bothered by something. And as long as we have this feeling of, so often we think, if only I had this, if only I had that, if I had all these things, then everything would be fine. My life would be just perfect and everything would go on as it should. But that's the fundamental, that's part of the fundamental delusion, the notion that what we lack is something outside here that the sense of self can grab onto and then somehow fill itself up and feel full. Even someone who is healthy and wealthy still experiences this fundamental sense of dukkha in the broadest sense. And that's the ultimate challenge. Does this make any sense? Let me refer to my notes, see what comes next. It's interesting that here we can benefit from what contemporary psychology has discovered. Because in the 20th century, I think Western psychology caught up with what the Buddha was saying. That it knows that the sense of self is, in contemporary terms, it's a construct. That it's not something there naturally, but rather it's something that is constructed slowly and often painfully in the course of childhood development. So it's a psychological, social, linguistic construct. Psychological, because it has to do with ways of thinking. Social, because we only learn what it means to have or be a sense of self from other people. If we didn't, like if we're a wolf child who's sort of taken away, you know, at a very early age as a baby and raised by wolves, that child, unless he's sort of found very, very quickly, he will never have the kind of self that we do, because there are certain stages in the formation of the self that are disrupted, and often they can't be made up again. And it also has to do with language, because a lot of getting the sort of proper sense of, well-functioning sense of self has to do with knowing how to use certain words. I, me, mine, you, yours, her, his. It's learning how to use those words in the proper way that are all involved with the sense of self. Nevertheless, although 20th century has caught up with Buddhism in a lot of ways, there are two fundamental differences, of course. First of all, a lot of traditional Western therapy is about repairing the sense of self, making it, helping it function better. Traditionally, back in the 50s, it was helping you fit in to the society, to your social roles and all that. And that was the goal, just to normalize so that you were like everybody else. And the difference with Buddhism, of course, is that for Buddhism, that's not enough. I mean, a healthy sense of self is still, from a Buddhist standpoint, still deluded, still full of dukkha. There's something that has to be realized, something that we have to go beyond. And that, of course, leads to the second, that the sense of self can be and needs to be both deconstructed and reconstructed. The deconstruction is what we're doing when we are meditating. What is the sense of self composed of? Well, fundamentally, it's composed of habitual ways of thinking, of, well, perceiving, seeing, hearing, and so forth. Habitual ways of perceiving, feeling, thinking, acting, reacting. It's the way these habitual patterns of behavior fit together and work together in a certain way that creates and sustains the illusion of a sense of self. The point of our meditation practice, then, is that when we're meditating or when we're being mindful, like we were just doing for 45 minutes a little earlier, I don't know precisely what your practice is, but for example, suppose it's following the breath. By following the breath wholeheartedly, fully, with full awareness, it means that as those other thoughts, feelings, memories, plans, expectations, etc., all those kind of mental phenomena and images, as they rise in the mind, we don't identify with any of them. We don't stick to them. But rather, we let them go by coming back to the breath counting. And if the sense of self is composed of those habitual patterns, do you see, by letting those patterns go, we are, in effect, deconstructing the sense of self. But why is the sense of self inherently uncomfortable? Dukkha. And why is it so difficult to do that? Why is it so difficult to deconstruct the sense of self? Well, if it's true that that's all the sense of self is, those habitual patterns of perceiving, feeling, thinking, acting, reacting, what happens when we strip them away, like the layers of an onion? Or we don't really strip them away, but we let them fall away in our practice. What happens when we get to the core? What's left? Anybody? Sorry?
Nothing.
So, nothing. Literally nothing. The basic problem is, we don't want to be nothing. That nothing is something that makes us very uncomfortable. Often very afraid. There's the fear of letting go and experiencing that nothingness. One way to say it, and I think this captures something very important. If the sense of self is just all of these patterns of behavior, etc., fitting together, then it's ungrounded. It doesn't have any reality of its own. It's a function. It's not a thing, right? And therefore, it is inherently insecure, because there's nothing there that could be secure. And that, I suggest to you, is at the root of our dukkha. The sense that as long as I have this feeling of a sense of self, this sense of self is inherently uncomfortable because it is insecure, and it cannot possibly be secured because there's nothing there that could be secured. That may seem a very strange claim to some of you, but in fact, I think we all experience this. I think we often experience it, especially in sort of adolescence, when the sense of self is coalescing separately from the family or from the parents. The way we experience this insecurity, this unreality, is, and I think we all have this in one form or other, we have the sense that there's something wrong with me. There's something that's missing. Something isn't right. Something, there's a sense of lack. And I think we all have this sense of lack, although in the process of growing up, we often learn to sort of push it on its side. So what I'm really suggesting is that the sense of self, the sense of separation, this, you know, David Loy, who, this person somehow supposedly in here, who, where, don't know who he is, don't know what he is, this sense of self, because it can't know what it is in the conventional sense, it's always shadowed or haunted by this sense of lack, by this sense that something is wrong with me, something isn't quite right. But how it is that we understand this sense of lack, that gets very interesting, because I think it varies a lot according to the kind of person we are, but also according to the kind of culture we're in, the kind of situation we're in. So for example, to grow up in the contemporary United States, one of the main ways that we're taught what our lack is we don't have enough money. Right. And it's quite remarkable when people have done studies of people of all different social brackets and income levels have been asked, well, how much money would you need to become happy? And they all say about the same thing. Between 25% and 50% more of their present income level, they would be happy. Doesn't matter whether they're earning $10,000 a year or $10 million a year. They tend to have the same thing. We're conditioned to understand our sense of lack as not enough money. Something that, a kind of conditioning that wouldn't have been true, for example, for medieval peasants in Europe, because they lived in a subsistence economy where there wasn't much money. That just wasn't an option for them. So that's one of the main ways that it comes out. And the problem, of course, is that, and this is the key, I think. If the problem really isn't money, but that money is just a symbol for this more fundamental sense of emptiness that we're so uncomfortable with, then no amount of money, it doesn't matter how much money you get, it's never going to be enough. It's like a bottomless hole or a pit that can't be filled. So, you know, you're on a treadmill, but you can never get enough money to fill up that sense of lack. Another example is our contemporary fascination with fame, becoming famous. Professors like myself in university, we don't have many illusions about getting rich, but we can always hope to become a little famous, or at least get a bit of a reputation, right, in our field. And that's another way that I think we tend to try to fill up our sense of life. It's interesting, that too wasn't an option in the Middle Ages. You know, peasants, you're not going to get famous. The king is famous, the pope is famous, St. Francis is famous, but you're not going to get famous, right? But we have this whole media machine, this incredibly sophisticated, where all kinds of famous people are being stuck in our face all the time. And somehow we get the idea that to be real is to be on TV. And the urge to be on TV, or the urge to be somewhat famous, something like that. I think, as Freud said, to be famous is to be loved by many anonymous people. But loved or not, at least you're noticed. And if we have this sense of unreality for all these other people to notice us, we can hope at least that it will somehow make us feel more real. So the need to become famous and then ever more famous is, I think, another contemporary American example. And a third one, women. I mean, to grow up a woman in this society is to be taught that your body is just not good enough, right? It's just not good enough. Even supermodels, when you read interviews with supermodels, what do they say? My thigh is got a little bit too much here. It's like women especially are conditioned to look at their bodies and compare what they see in the mirror with their image of mega girl that they get from Cosmo or whatever it is that they read. So this is a third example of, I think, the way in which society has ways of feeding on our sense of lack, and often using it to kind of sell us something. But these are particularly modern, maybe even especially American, ways of understanding our sense of lack. And they all have the same problem. They all teach us, they're all conditioning us to understand that our problem is something out here. That if I just had this, this would include my body. If my body was just the way it is, Playboy, I don't know. Or if I just had as much money as Donald Trump, or if I just was as famous as, take your pick, then everything would be okay. And it's interesting, I think the very low self-esteem that seems to plague so many people, most noticeably school kids, of course, in this society has to do with a lot of the ways that all of these senses of lack are promoted in this society. We are conditioned to understand that we're not good enough. The whole society is teaching us we're not good enough. And that's playing on this fundamental sense of lack that I was talking about. Does this make any sense? Does this fit in with your understanding of Buddhism? I think that this understanding of the sense of self being haunted by a sense of lack, I think it helps us understand karma, which is otherwise quite a big problem for the Buddhist tradition, karma and rebirth. Do we really know how we should understand them today? In so many ways, Buddhism is a very contemporary religion. What it says about the sense of self being a construct, what it says about the way language deceives us, 20th century philosophy is all about that. Interdependence, like ecology. In so many ways, Buddhism would seem to be the religion of the 21st century, and yet, how do we understand karma and rebirth? I'm not going to talk about rebirth, but I do want to just say a few words about karma, which I think we need to interrogate and to really think how should we understand it? Is it really some kind of impersonal law of the universe? Kind of Newton's third law of motion, you know, what you throw out comes back to you. Is it really that simple? Is that really the way the cosmos is structured, or can we understand it in a different way? There's not time to go into it here, but what I want to suggest to you is simply this, that karma isn't something that the self has, it's what the sense of self is. What is the sense of self? We said just a minute ago, it's the way these habitual ways of perceiving, thinking, feeling, acting, reacting, how they fit together. And the most important of those is our motivations. What motivates what we do? And this was the real innovation of the Buddha that tends to be overlooked. Prior to the Buddha, karma was understood in a very mechanical fashion, as if you sacrificed or did a ritual in exactly the right way with the Brahmin, then you would get what you sacrificed for. It was very kind of mechanistic. And the Buddha's great revolution, and I think it was emphasizing karma by emphasizing motivation. Basically, the most important part of our sense of self is our motivation. And you can change the quality of your life. You can change the way you perceive the world. You can change the way the world responds to you. How? Very simple, although not necessarily easy. By transforming your motivations behind what you do. Buddhism doesn't talk about evil, but it talks a great deal about the three roots of evil, the three poisons, the three unwholesome motivations. Anybody know what those are? Does that sound familiar?
Greed, hatred, delusion.
So, greed, hatred, or ill will, and delusion. So, basically what the Buddha is saying is when you are motivated by that, then you're going to cause problems for yourself and for other people. But if you're motivated by the opposite, that is to say, generosity, loving kindness, and the wisdom of realizing our non-duality, then when we act in that way, we will come to experience the world in a different way. We will actually perceive it differently, and people will also respond to us. So what I think the Buddha is getting at, and I think this is very profound, is just as the food that I eat is digested and metabolized to become my body, so the actions, the intentional actions that I perform are transforming my sense of self by transforming motivations. If my motivations are habitually greed, ill will, delusion, they're going to reinforce this sense of separate self, right? If I'm manipulating you to get what I want out of you, that's going to reinforce my sense of separateness, and yours, you're going to tend to react negatively insofar as, you know, you become aware of that. And so that'll all reinforce the basic problem. But it's just the opposite. If the way I live is motivated by generosity, sharing, loving kindness, and as I said, fundamentally the wisdom of the fact that we're not really all separate from each other, then I can relax. I can relax wholly. I can open up without fear of loss, because in a way, there's nothing to lose. If we realize that we're not separate from each other, if I realize that I'm empty, then at a fundamental level, I also realize that there's nothing to lose. And then there's this fundamental sense of relaxation, opening up. Other people pick this up. They respond to us in a similar way. We experience the world in a different way. That's what I think the Buddha was getting at with karma. Maybe there's other magical things to it. I don't want to deny that possibility. But I think this is a very important part of it that we can understand pretty much by itself. There's a famous, as far as I know, anonymous verse that kind of sums it up very well. Maybe you know the source. You've probably heard it. Sow, like sowing a seed in the ground. sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow a deed and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. I think that's very profound, and I think that that's what Buddha was kind of getting at when he was talking about the importance of motivations and the way in which motivations reconstruct not only the sense of self, but they reconstruct by changing the motivations behind what I do from the negative to the positive. They not only reconstruct my character, but they also reconstruct the way I experience the world and the world responds to me. Does that make any sense? But that's all about reconstruction. That, and it's interesting because Buddhism distinguishes good karma from awakening. Not, you know, good karma is important, but it's not awakening. And so in terms of what I've been talking about, how should we understand awakening? I've already hinted at it a couple times. But to go back to what I was saying about letting go of all of these things. Just to say it one more time, if the sense of self is basically made up, constructed of these habitual thought, feeling, perceiving, acting patterns, the way they work together as a process, then when we are being mindful, when we are meditating, when we are not reinforcing them, but rather by letting them go, it is in effect allowing the onion to peel itself, to getting back to that fundamental core, except there is no core, there's nothing there. And there's something very scary about that in most cases. We're afraid to let go of the sense of self. In the Zen world, it's talked about like falling into a void. One of the great Zen masters says, it's not really the void, it's the realm of the true Dharma. There's a lot in Buddhism about letting go. Certainly in the Zen tradition, which I'm coming from. And for example, the great Japanese Zen master Dogen, 13th century, he said, to study Buddhism is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget yourself. To forget yourself is to realize your intimacy, your oneness, your non-duality, if you will, with the 10,000 things. To forget yourself. For the sense of self to let go of itself, to forget itself, and to wake up. Also in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about a paravritti. That's the Sanskrit term, paravritti, a turning around at the core. The basic problem is that we usually experience this emptiness at the core as something terrifying that we try to run away from, that we're always trying to fill it up, or either trying to stuff something in it, or somehow evade it. But the only real problem is that we think that emptiness is a problem. In a way, you can say meditation is becoming friends with that emptiness, making friends with it, making friends with that hole that is at our core. And awakening, one way to describe awakening is when there's that transformation at the base, transformation at the core, when what was experienced as this great sense of lack, of something wrong, something isn't right, there's kind of a turning around, and this becomes the hole at our core from which something greater than ourselves bubbles up. I'm not sure how to say it. The source of our creativity. It's like once there's the letting go, once there's nothing that needs to be defended or hid, it opens up to this something flowing. It's like a bottomless spring, a fountain. We don't know the source of the fountain, but we don't need to know the source of the fountain. That's what I am. It's my life is living that, manifesting that. It's also freeing. It's also freedom because there's nothing that, at this point, there's nothing that needs to be attained or gained or lost, but it is a kind of an opening up. I think this also keys pretty closely with what we know about creativity, which is to say the most creative stuff is deeper than the ego. It's not something that the sense of self creates. It comes from somewhere deeper, doesn't it? You don't know where it comes from. I mean, when you read stories of the great musicians, Bach and Mozart and Beethoven, they all talk about God gave it to me. Well, that's one way of talking, but it's like, it's not that I did it, but rather I got out of the way. I, in the sense of the ego self, kind of got out of the way and opened up to this that sort of flows naturally through me. Dogen later described his experience, his own experience. He said, I came to realize clearly that mind, my mind, is nothing other than rivers and mountains and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. If there's no inside, there's no outside. When there's that loss of separation, what is there? What's left? The outside is not outside. David Loy is not this consciousness somehow up here in the head looking out at you. David Loy is what the whole universe, it's one way the whole universe comes together. All this incredibly complicated web of causes and conditions, interdependence, it's one way this whole web comes together and manifests right now. David Loy isn't something inside, it's simply the way that all this comes together. And of course, that's equally true for each and every one of us, right? The only difference between a Buddha and the rest of us is that the Buddha knows it, whereas we still have this delusion of separation, self, and therefore all the dukkha that goes along with it. To put it that way makes it sound all or nothing, doesn't it? And I don't know that it's that way. I think often we have a little taste of this creativity, this paravritti, non-duality. But I think it does say something very important about the kind of path that we're all embarked upon. Maybe I should stop here and see whether this makes any sense, enough sense for some questions.